Start out by asking you a question. You can respond honestly. Want to hear individual words. What words come to mind when you think of family? What words come to mind? Love.
Knuckleheads.
Okay. What's that? Support. Children. Did someone say food? Grief. Okay. What else? Laughter. Say again. Brood. Rude. R-U-D-E. I notice your family's not here. You can say that. Except for your husband. Patience.
Comfort.
Friend. Sharing.
Joy.
Anything else? You guys mostly said positive words. You need to be, you know, I know some of your families. There's more to say. Pain, yeah. Dysfunctional, okay. I got some applause for that one. Frustrating, yeah.
Sorrow.
Yeah, families are a mixed bag, right? They can be really great things, they can be really difficult things. Thomas Jefferson once said this, "The happiest moments of my life have been the few which I have passed at home in the bosom of my family." You probably received that on a card someday, didn't you? And sometimes that's true. Sometimes God really blesses us and there are amazing times within our families. But not always. Sometimes there are really hard things. Sometimes there's pain and hurt, even betrayal. George Carlin once said this, "The other night I ate at a real nice family restaurant. Every table had an argument going." And sometimes that's our experience of family. Conflict, fighting, disagreements. Whatever your experience of family that has been, though, one thing is true for all of us. We want a family. We want a healthy family. We want a place where we are cared for, where we have the opportunity to care for others. That's a desire that God's given us. Some of us have caught glimpses of that, and it's made us want it. It's made us want to create that, to experience that. Some of us have been really disappointed by the experiences in our family. We've been hurt by those. And that desire has stirred a longing within us for what we were created for. Those are the things we want to take into the study we're looking at this morning. The warmth, the joy, but also the disappointment, the frustration, and the longing. Today we're continuing in our Lenten series, looking at the seven last things that Jesus said while he hung on the cross, while he was dying. We're looking at this in an effort to dive deep into the experience of the cross, hoping that we would understand more of what happened there, that we would understand emotionally, in our hearts, more of what happened, that somehow God would use this experience to change us, to draw us closer to him. And today we're looking at the third statement from the cross. It's the first one in the Gospel of John. It's listed as the first thing that Jesus said. And it's a statement that Jesus makes to his mother, Mary, and to the disciple, John, who affectionately refers to himself as the beloved disciple. And as we've seen with the past two statements, on first glance, it's a simple statement. It's very easy to understand. But as you go deeper into it, you realize there are these layers. There's more and more that Jesus is saying in this. And so what is at the face a simple statement of caring to two people who are hurting also becomes this profoundly theological twist, this shocking redefinition of one of the basic things that we understand about the world. So first, we're going to look at Jesus, and we're going to see how he responds to other people in the midst of himself going through something painful. And then we're going to look at these two individuals, Mary and John, and look at what Jesus does for them, and how that creates this pattern of how we are to relate to each other. And then finally, we'll go deeper and look at this profoundly theological thing that Christ is doing, this shocking, countercultural, even challenging statement that he's making, and try and understand what exactly he's trying to do in the world. So let's start by reading the statement. It's in John chapter 19, and I'll read from verses 25 to 27. Near the cross of Jesus stood his mother's sister, Mary the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. When Jesus saw his mother there, and the disciple whom he loved, standing nearby, he said to his mother, "Dear woman, here is your son." And to the disciple, "Here is your mother." From that time on, this disciple took her into his home. Just before this, John has described how, as Jesus was dying, the soldiers around him saw it as an opportunity to get free stuff. So they're casting lots, gambling for his clothes. And we're meant to see a contrast between those soldiers who saw an opportunity and Mary and these four women who are gathered in grief near the cross to watch Jesus die and to grieve that event. One of the most remarkable things about watching Jesus on the cross is seeing his perspective, and in particular, his attitude towards the people around him. He's going through something incredibly painful, the hardest thing he's ever had to do. But in the midst of that, he sees the pain of other people. Even on the cross, Jesus is other-focused. All of the statements have revealed that, but none as clear as this one, where in the midst of his pain, he notices two individuals in their grief. Jake showed me a YouTube video recently called Man Cold. Has anybody seen this? Oh, good. Then I can butcher it. It shows a picture of a man who gets a cold. And of course, he's lying in bed in agony from his cold. And he weakly calls for his wife. And she doesn't hear him, so he calls 911. The paramedics come immediately. And they scold the woman for not caring for this ailing man. And they prop up his pillows and they give the wife a little bell and say, "When he rings this, you come immediately. He has a cold." And the wife says, well, "I feel sick too." And they say, "Well, take some cough syrup. This guy has a man cold and he needs to be taken care of." And it struck me because it's kind of the way it happens in my house, actually. See, when Rachel gets sick, she does everything that she normally does. But when I get sick, everything stops. I got to be taken care of. And I have to admit, sometimes I actually get a bell. So that's, I know. That's my confession for the morning. I ring the bell. "Could I have a glass of water?" I know. Now, husbands may, in general, be worse than this than wives. But I think it's true for all of us that when we're going through something difficult, we tend to get self-centered. When we're going through pain, we tend to block out everything else around us. The only thing that matters is our experience, our hurt, our suffering. Pain has this amazing ability to just draw us inward. And so it's remarkable that as Jesus is going through the most painful thing he's ever experienced, he notices the people around him, and he notices their suffering. And so we get this first example that Jesus gives us, that even as we are hurting, even in the midst of our suffering, we can love those around us. We can love even when it hurts. Love when it hurts. That doesn't mean we ignore our own pain. It doesn't mean we stuff it down or don't deal with it. Next week, we'll talk about how Jesus experiences pain. We'll see him crying out to God, being honest in the midst of what is tremendous pain. But it does mean that even as we experience our own pain, we can reach out to those who are suffering around us. It's noticing the pain of others. Can we love even when we are hurting. And that's exactly what we've seen Jesus do throughout his life and ministry. He's always been other-focused. He's always noticed other people, reached out to them. And what happens is we find out, as we get to know Jesus on the cross, as we dive deeper into this experience of his crucifixion, we end up noticing what he notices. We don't notice so much the pain of Jesus, but as we get closer to Jesus, we notice the pain of the world. We're drawn into him, and we see what he sees, which is the pain of other people around him. I don't really care that much about chickens. I think they're kind of odd, to be honest. However, in the past year or more, I've spent several hours building 2 chicken coops. I have sat watching TV with a chicken on the couch next to me. True story. I have cooked in the kitchen with a chicken perched on a stool next to me. Don't worry, I wouldn't serve you food after that, but the chickens are usually outside, but they do come inside on occasions that aren't so rare. And just yesterday, we were watching TV, and there was a chicken sitting in my nice leather chair. So here's the thing. My wife likes chickens, and she wants chickens, and I like my wife. So because I care for her, I have chickens. And I have to be honest, I'm starting to kind of, sort of, think that chickens are a little bit cute. This is what happens. As we get close to someone, we end up caring about the things that they care about. As we get close to Jesus, we end up caring about the things that Jesus cares about, which is the pain of other people. And so the question for us then becomes, can we love others even when it hurts? Can we be that other-focused? How has getting to know Jesus helped you to open up your eyes and notice others? So this is the first thing we observe about Jesus, that he has this remarkable ability, sets this remarkable example for us to love even when it hurts. But what does he do then? He's moved to action. He's moved to do something out of his love. And he does something for 2 individuals, Mary and John. So we have to think a little bit about who this woman Mary is. She's a remarkable woman in the scriptures. We don't talk that much about her, I think because we're afraid of sounding too Catholic or something. But Mary is actually incredible. She doesn't appear in the Gospel of John except for 2 times. Once here, and once at the very beginning of the story, where she asks her son Jesus to intervene in this situation where a family's throwing a wedding feast and they've run out of wine. And she wants Jesus to act to take away the disgrace, the dishonor that this family would feel if their party ended up being a flop. That's the first we hear of her. The second we hear of her is now. These 2 scenes bookend the story of Jesus in the Gospel of John. In the first, he was asked to take away the disgrace of one family. Now he's acting to take away the disgrace of the world. And Mary shows up in both places. The other gospel authors give us more information about her. The Gospel of Luke tells us about how she became the mother of Jesus. Mary, as an unwed, teenage, pregnant girl. Can you imagine the shame that she felt as her belly started to grow and she had to explain to people and nobody believed her? I mean, even in our culture, young, unwed, pregnant women feel shame. Imagine the first century AD in a conservative Jewish village. The shame she felt. And then she gives birth to Jesus and she has to be mommy to the Messiah. How does that work? How do you parent God? The other day, one of my kids asked me, walking to school, she said, "Daddy, did Jesus make mistakes as a kid?" And I said, "Huh, I don't know. I imagine he didn't disobey his parents, but did he color outside the lines? Or did he spell words wrong? I don't know. I would imagine so. He was a kid, right? But he was God. How do you parent? How do you mother God and raise this child?" And then at the end of a long life of struggling with things, here's Mary watching her 33-year-old son be tortured, beaten, humiliated, and executed for something he didn't do, for something other people did. Can you imagine the pain that she feels as a mother to watch this? She was warned that her burden would be a heavy one. When Jesus was little, she took him to the temple to be circumcised, and the priest Simeon told her this. It's recorded in Luke chapter 2, verse 34 and 35. This child is destined to cause the falling and rising of many in Israel, and to be a sign that will be spoken against, so that the thoughts of many hearts will be revealed, and a sword will pierce your own soul too, he says to Mary. And so now, as a spear pierces the side of her son, a sword pierces her soul. The end of a long and difficult journey as the mother of Jesus. And so Jesus sees her and says, "Dear woman, here is your son. Here is your new son. And disciple, here is your mother." The language he uses is powerful language. One commentator calls it the language of testamentary disposition. That's a fancy legal way to say this is serious stuff. This is Jesus declaring in a legal, official sense that these two people are now mother and son. It's the language you would find in a last will and testament. It's akin to what happens when I lead weddings and two people walk through the doors who aren't husband and wife, and then I say, "I now pronounce you husband and wife." And something happens, and these two people have changed. Their identity has changed. That's what Jesus does here. Here is your mother. Here is your son. But we have to ask, why does Jesus do this? Mary is still young. She's probably not yet 50. She doesn't need someone to take care of her. The New Testament seems to say that she has other children that could do that. John is a grown man. He doesn't need a mother to feed him, change his diaper. Why does he give these two to each other? Well, remember what we noticed Jesus doing at the beginning. In the midst of his pain, he noticed the pain of others. And now what he's doing is he sees two people who are grieving, and he gives each of them another person who is also grieving. To help them in their pain, he gives them responsibility for someone else who is in pain. He does for them what he himself is doing, giving them the opportunity to love someone else, even as they suffer. Jesus gives Mary a son to care for her, but also for her to care for. And he gives John a mother that he might be cared for and care for her. And it teaches something about how God asks us to live in a world where there is so much pain, where we experience so much pain. When we're hurting, it can be so tempting to just disappear within ourselves, to explore all the minute details of what we're feeling and what we're experiencing and how hard it is, and to try to understand what happened and how do we get out of it, and just be lost in this endless maze of our own suffering. And there are times where it's important to spend time doing that, to go to counseling, to receive therapy, to find healing. There are times where we have to explore our pain, but it's not a place to stay. In the midst of our pain, Jesus gives us the opportunity to recognize other people in pain. And we realize that it's not just possible to love when it hurts, it actually helps to love another person, even as we're suffering. And so Jesus starts by giving us this example of loving when it hurts, and now he gives us a relationship where we can do that, where we can serve someone and be served ourselves. Serve and be served. He sets up this relationship for Mary and John of mutual care and concern, where they each take care of each other. And this is how God works. This is how God puts people together so that they might care for each other and get something in return. But there's always this drive, there's always this desire within us to be independent, to handle it on our own, to block out other people, to just manage, just tough it up and get through it, to not involve other people because involving other people makes it messy and complicated and we feel weak and it's just easier to just be strong. But that's not what Jesus does here. He gives us each other people in their pain to come alongside each other. Now, once you enter into this type of relationship, it can get distorted. There are some people who are only interested in being served, who want the world to revolve around them, who don't want to help anybody else. I'm the youngest child in my family, so I'm fairly used to people taking care of me, as the bell might indicate. I sometimes tell people that I have the spiritual gift of being served. But I've actually checked, and it's not a real spiritual gift. So if you think you have that gift, I'm sorry to disappoint you as well. But it's not healthy to just receive. There's a mutual relationship. The other side isn't healthy either, though. There are some people who are very comfortable giving. They're very comfortable serving and helping and taking care of other people. But as soon as you try and help them, the walls go up. And that's not a good place to be either. We exist in a relationship where we take care of each other. And when we fail to allow others to take care of us, we deny them something. It doesn't become a real relationship. It's one-sided in a different way. Love happens when you serve and allow others to serve you. That's what Jesus is establishing here. That's the relationship that he's giving. So what we've seen so far is Jesus taking care of two people whom he loves. He's taking care of this woman who is dear to him. He's taking care of this disciple that he loves. But at the same time as he's doing that, he's doing something huge, big in the world, profoundly theological and shocking and challenging and maybe even a little offensive. See, he could have said, Mary, please take care of John. John, please take care of Mary. He could have said, you'll find relief in your own pain as you care for this other person. Take care of each other. But he doesn't. He says, woman, here is your son. Son, here is your mother. He chooses a particular relationship, that of mother and child, which is arguably the most intimate relationship there is. Fathers can walk away from their kids, and they sometimes do. Husbands and wives split up and leave each other. Siblings turn against each other, but there's something about a mother and a child that is incredible. That's the relationship that Jesus gives to these two people. And what he's doing is more than just caring for them. He's saying something about the nature of family itself. He's redefining family in terms of himself. Now, it's popular to hear people talk about the virtues of family, to hold up family as the highest value. You hear politicians talk this way about family values. You hear sociologists talk about family as the building block of any society. Counselors talk about what happened in your family. There's whole organizations that deal with how to have good families. And sometimes in church and in Christian circles, we hold up family as if it is the most important thing. That is what God is ultimately concerned about, our families. But Jesus says some tricky things about families that challenge some of those ideas. One time when he was busy explaining some theological concepts to a bunch of people, his mother and his brothers were outside asking for him. And he says this in Matthew chapter 12. I'll read from verse 48 to 50. He replied to him, "Who is my mother? And who are my brothers?" Pointing to his disciples, he said, "Here are my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of my Father in heaven is my brother and sister and mother." I don't know about you, but if I said that to my mom, I'd get in trouble. It sounds like he's just a rebellious child. It sounds like he's got some new fame. He's got a crowd of people around him, and he's saying to his mom, I don't need you anymore. This is my family now. But he's not saying that. What he's doing is he's saying that the very nature of family itself is redefined around me. When you follow Jesus, something changes. Now, this is challenging, but the idea that he's saying is that the church is actually the new family of God. Your brothers and sisters are now those who profess Christ. Your parents are the elders, not the capital E elders, but the older ones among us. These are your parents in the family of God. Your children are the children within the church. This is actually the new family of God. And on one level, we all know this. We talk about it all the time. Brothers and sisters, we talk like that. But I don't think we really believe it. I think what we mean when we say that is that this place is supposed to be like a family. We are like brothers and sisters to each other. And so we treat each other as if we were brothers and sisters. We think that family is a metaphor that helps us a little bit better understand how to act in this community. But what if we have it backwards? What if this is the real thing? What if the family of God is the real family and our earthly families are just metaphors to help us understand how the church is supposed to be? What if the most important thing is understanding how God is our Father and how we are each other's brothers and sisters? What if that's what's real? And that's what Jesus is doing. He's putting Mary and John as his disciples in this new relationship and saying, around me, the whole idea of family changes. Maybe the reason we were given earthly fathers and mothers and brothers and sisters is so that we can understand how to be in the church. So that when our children obey us, we know something of the humility of authority. And when our children disobey us, we know something of the sting of rejection that God feels when we turn on Him. When our parents love us and care for us, we know something of what our Heavenly Father might be like. And when our parents fail us, we are filled with this longing that drives us toward finding the true Father who truly loves us. When our siblings care for us, we know something of what it means to be in a community where people take care of each other. And when they don't, we are driven to find the place that we know is out there. And we find it here in the church. This is where everything comes together. In the midst of pain, Jesus asks us to love others. He sets up a relationship where we might serve one another and be served ourselves. And then he says, the family is that relationship. And as people gather in worship around me, that is the family. Come home to this place. Come home to what your true family is. Come home here. Many of you know that we've had two foster children as part of our earthly family for the last 18 months. We recently found out that a week from this Tuesday, our adoption of them will be complete. So we're very excited, and it's a really big deal, and it's just kind of crazy to think about that pronouncement that we're going to experience soon. That morning I'll wake up and three children will call me daddy, and that afternoon there'll be five that do so. And one of the things that's really struck me about that process is that after we adopt these children, the state of California will give us new birth certificates that list Paul and Rachel Taylor as their parents. We will officially, from that day, be their parents. The state does something, and all of a sudden, we're their parents. It's crazy. A month from now, we'll celebrate Easter here at PVC, and we'll celebrate by having a baptism, where some of us will go underwater, and come back up to a new birth. And one of the languages that's used in the New Testament of baptism is that of adoption, that you come up out of the water with a new father, but not just a new father, new brothers and sisters. You are reborn, and you have a new birth certificate with new parents and a new family. This is some heavy theological stuff. These are big ideas that Jesus is actually completely redefining the basic fundamental unit of society. He's saying family only points you to the church, to the gathered people of God. And so it takes some time to figure out, well, what does this mean in our lives? But it changes things. It changes the way we live. It changes how we spend our time. It changes how we spend our money. If this is really our family, life is different. We don't have biological family in the area, so when we were having children, we kept saying, well, it's harder when you don't have family in the area. But we do have family in the area. This changes everything. Now, it can also be misapplied. There are people who disregard their biological children or biological parents. They disregard their earthly family for the sake of church activities, and they end up neglecting real responsibilities God has given us. So this doesn't mean that we don't have responsibilities to the earthly family that we're a part of. What it means is that our fundamental identity has shifted. It means that this is our new family. This is our primary belonging place. And there's a whole lot of stuff that flows from that about how do you live that out? How does that change the way we live? We are literally the family of God. So once again, with one simple statement, Jesus has done some incredible stuff. On one level, he's taken care of two people that he loves. He's given us an example of what it means to love others when you're experiencing pain. He set up a relationship of mutual care for Mary and John so that they can care for each other in the midst of their grief. But he's also totally redefined the very nature of family itself to be centered around him. His Father is the Father. We are his brothers and sisters. So when you put all these things together, it provides this amazing picture of what it looks like to live in this world, to live in a world where there is so much pain and so many people hurting, and to understand that God has acted in a way that people can live in pain by caring for each other, by loving others in the midst of their suffering, and by coming together in a family that provides that support. We suffer. But in our suffering, we love each other. That's the family of God. Come and be a part of this family. Find your family at the cross. God, we are thankful that you are our true Father, and we ask you to help us work out what that means. Help us to figure out how to apply that, how that changes the way we live. Thank you for this community of brothers and sisters. And God, we pray that we would be drawn closer to your Son, Jesus, and in that, closer to each other as we recognize and reach out toward the pain in this world. We pray in the name of that Son, our brother, Jesus. Amen.